It is Wednesday, August 31st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, a major Islamic State figure is reported dead in Syria. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry makes a plea for India to enhance its leadership on the global stage, and Asian American cuisine enjoys rising popularity. It's all ahead. A U.S. official tells VOA that Russia's claim that it carried out the airstrike in Syria that killed Islamic State spokesman and chief strategist is garbage. In a statement, Russia's defense ministry said Russian warplanes killed up to 40 IS militants, including Abu Muhammad al-Adnani, during a bombing raid near Aleppo province on Tuesday. The United States said coalition forces had targeted Adnani in an airstrike in the Syrian city of Al-Bab. The Pentagon said it's still assessing the result of that strike. Russia has been carrying out its own bombing campaign in support of Syrian leader Bashar al-Assad. Islamic State itself announced Abu Muhammad al-Adnani's death Tuesday, saying only that he was killed while surveying the operations to repel the military campaigns against Aleppo. Greg Barton, a terrorism expert at Australia's Deakin University, tells International Edition's Victor Beattie, Adnani, whether he's dead or alive, has been more than just a spokesman, but an effective number two man behind IS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi.
He's not just somebody who's been an effective spokesperson in the role of a religious leader issuing fatwa, but also a strategist and a planner and a leader behind the scenes working with Baghdadi. The fact that Islamic State is speaking of his death means either that it's confirmation or that they've got some elaborate plan to spirit him away. Either way, we're speaking about somebody who is a key player with Islamic State.
U.S. offered a $5 million reward for his capture just last year.
Yeah, that speaks to how valuable he's seen as being and what a senior role he's playing. If anything, that could be a reward which probably have increased in value over the last year because his role is being recognized now as being more important than we thought at first. One of his recent fatwa was issued before Ramadan, calling for a month of blood, a call which unfortunately was answered not just in the Middle East but also in Europe. And of course, we first began to think about him in a significant way in September 2014 when he gave a call, a fatwa, saying attack the crusaders wherever they are, wherever you are, with what you have at hand. Use your car to run them over, cut their throats with a kitchen knife. You don't have to come and fight in the battlefields of Iraq and Syria. You can do it where you are. And of course, that call was answered literally within days. Melbourne, Australia, where a young man lashed out at police officers, losing his life in the process, and then many other attacks since then.
Do you think his fingerprints might have been on attacks like Orlando, Florida, and Nice, France?
I think we can certainly say that the orchestrated and directed attacks like Nice and Paris would have involved some sign-off or some collaboration with Adnani. The other sort of attacks, San Bernardino, Orlando, those seem to be crowdsourced, inspired attacks rather than directed and planned attacks. But the whole business of crowdsourcing and inspiring such attacks involves artful use of communications and marketing, of which Adnani played a key role.
Is this just another sign of Islamic State's decline?
It certainly seems to be that, even if the news is false, even if it turns out that Adnani, in fact, hasn't been killed, but they're trying to spirit him away from U.S. and other attention, it speaks to the fact that the ground is moving under them, that they're preparing for a different phase of the conflict. It's still a long-running conflict before it's finished.
That's Greg Barton. He is at Australia's Deakin University. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. Andrew, I understand there's a lot going on.
There is a lot going on today, and we start with the breaking news out of Brazil that President Dilma Rousseff has officially been removed from office by Brazil's Senate by a vote of 61 to 20. So we're seeing a lot of Dilma opponents on Twitter and Facebook praising this, saying it's a new beginning for the country. I also saw some reporters on the ground actually taking pictures of fences up in some of the cities to try to keep protesters away from each other in case they start to mobilize as a result of this if they take to the streets. So more on that on social media. We'll definitely see some of those images if those protests develop. The other big breaking story is that a short time ago, JetBlue Flight 386 landed in Cuba. Now, this is very important because it is the first commercial U.S. to Cuba flight in more than 50 years. So a lot of people very excited about this on social media, thinking that this is the start for tourism.
Yeah.
As this normalization of relations has slowly happened between the U.S. and Cuba, one thing we've seen again and again on social media is people saying, okay, well, when can I travel there? I really want to go on vacation to Cuba. So now this is another step in that direction with these flights starting to resume. Between the U.S. and Cuba, there are about going to be, I think, 20 flights that they're going to start with and hope to expand that. But a lot of hope and excitement about that for sure. Then we have Donald Trump in Mexico, going to Mexico City today to meet with that country's president. A lot of speculation as to what that meeting might bring, what they might talk about, especially some of the harsh words between them. And finally, new poll finds that Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are equally unpopular, and we see time and time again these people on social media saying, out of a country of over 300 million people, these are the two that we picked to run for president. So people saying, of course, they're unpopular, but what can we do? They're the choices that we have.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. Here are some of the top stories trending. The Brazilian Senate votes to oust Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff. The first U.S. commercial flight lands in Cuba after 50 years. South Korea says North Korea's vice premier has been executed. And Donald Trump heads to Mexico before describing his immigration plans. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Astronomers have spotted the most distant galaxy cluster so far. Using a number of NASA space telescopes, including the Hubble and Chandra X-ray Observatory, along with powerful ground-based telescopes, the astronomers say they may have caught the cluster right after its birth. The galaxy cluster is called CLJ-1001 and is located some 1.1 billion light-years from Earth. Galaxy clusters are areas of the universe where perhaps hundreds of galaxies group together and are bound to each other by gravity. Astronomers say there are 11 massive galaxies located at the center of this galaxy cluster. Along with its incredible distance from Earth, the scientists say another fascinating factor of its discovery is finding that it's undergoing astonishing growth and its core is cranking out over 3,000 stars a year. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, peace talks begin in Myanmar. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is continuing his visit in India and on Wednesday called on the country to take greater responsibility on the global stage along with the United States. I'm joined now by VOA State Department correspondent Steve Herman. So, Steve, how did Mr. Kerry's talks with Indian students go?
Well, he gave a speech and then took a few questions from students of the elite Indian Institute of Technology on the Delhi campus. He congratulated everyone for actually showing up because of the flooded conditions in Delhi, which have made driving very hazardous in the past couple of days and also caused the Secretary of State's motorcade to get stuck in traffic when it was coming from the airport to the hotel on Monday evening. But it was quite a wide-ranging speech. Basically, Kerry was making the pitch that India is the world's largest democracy and is a country that has really emerged now onto the global stage, needs to be a global leader and help work with the United States as a fellow democracy in tackling all sorts of problems, from countering violent extremism to combating the effects of climate change.
What did he say about global security threats, say, such as terrorism?
What he said is there's not going to be one country that's going to be able to defeat the scourge of terrorism, nor is there going to be one decisive battle that causes terrorism to go away. and countries such as India and the United States need to better share intelligence. And that is something that they have instituted. And it is a remarkable change for the relationship between these two countries, because the United States for many decades was essentially allied and a major supporter of Pakistan, India's rival and neighbor. So this relationship, he said, has gone to a level that is absolutely unprecedented, but he still wants to see India do more.
And what did he say about China and Beijing's militarization of the South China Sea?
Yes, he did make reference to the recent International Tribunal decision, which he says is binding. And he also mentioned India's role in patrolling in the Bay of Bengal. And again, in a joint statement that the two countries issued after their security and commercial dialogue, it did note these issues in the South China Sea and upholding freedom of navigation and safe passage. So it's very significant that the United States has gotten India to agree to that statement. But the Indians do have rising concerns about the rise of China militarily and its intentions in the region, both close and far away from India.
All right. Thanks very much, Steve. That's VOA State Department correspondent Steve Herman reporting from New Delhi, India. Talks designed to end nearly seven decades of fighting between Myanmar's government and ethnic rebel groups opened in the capital of Naypyidaw Wednesday. Delegates from 17 ethnic minorities filled the convention hall, mingling with military officers and diplomats at the start of the five-day conference, a major initiative of Aung San Suu Kyi's first days as leader of Myanmar's new democratically elected government. Reporter Paul Vries is in Naypyidaw and tells me about the conference.
Well, the previous government, which was a quasi-civilian government, already initiated reforms and also started a peace process that was partially successful. And it signed a joint ceasefire with eight groups last year. But those groups are not considered the most important groups and not the most powerful groups either. So what Aung San Suu Kyi has done after she won an election victory with her National League for Democracy last year, she's taken over this peace process and she's put her own people in within the mechanisms of the peace process so she can control it. And then she has broadened it to include more groups. And she's tried to include all groups. She has succeeded in getting almost everyone in there except for three rebel groups. So this has been the most inclusive peace conference and the first peace conference by Aung San Suu Kyi's government.
Now, United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is calling on the government of Myanmar to confer citizenship on the Rohingya Muslim minority. What are some of the complications involved in that?
That is a very politically sensitive issue in Myanmar. And so that group is viewed quite negatively as many people think they are illegal immigrants, though they claim to have been inside Myanmar for generations, and there's plenty of evidence to suggest that. But that is very contentious politically, and that will be very hard, even for Aung San Suu Kyi, to do.
Yeah, because in the past, leader Aung San Suu Kyi, she has been criticized, she and the government have been criticized quite strongly for their dealings with the Rohingya, for almost ignoring them.
Yeah, well, that is correct. Pretty much for the same reason I just mentioned, it is politically very sensitive. A lot of people in the Buddhist majority here don't view that group as belonging in Myanmar. I mean, there's evidence to suggest they've been there very long, and generations, and most of them used to have citizenship before. But yeah, Aung San Suu Kyi's party and she herself have done little to speak out on behalf of the Rohingya and their human rights.
What role could the military have in these, or are they having, in these peace talks and in sort of the overall political landscape as all this evolves?
Well, the military remains very powerful politically. They've sort of cemented themselves into the political structure because of the constitution which they wrote. So they have all sorts of means to influence the political process, and they have just autonomy over the security sector. So they are the key to solving the conflict. They seem to be very willing at this stage to go along with the peace process and to let Aung San Suu Kyi take the lead on that. But, for instance, for this conference, the military had a disagreement with three groups, and they wanted a certain statement from them. The three groups didn't comply, and so those three groups could not join this conference. So that shows also the military still can set the boundaries pretty clearly.
That's reporter Paul Vries in Naypyidaw, Myanmar. This is VOA.
Democracy in action. That's what the U.S. presidential election is all about. Who's going to be the new president of the United States come November 8th? Tune in to VOA's coverage of the 2016 presidential election. Reports, expert analysis, and more. Professional, up-to-the-minute coverage that can't be found anywhere else. Right here on VOA.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is International Edition. For much of the 20th century, for some Americans, Asian food meant chop suey or chow mein or other Chinese-style dishes. Well, no longer. Americans may now choose from restaurants featuring Japanese, Thai, Korean, Indian, Burmese, and other Asian cuisines. In her documentary, Off the Menu, filmmaker Grace Lee traveled off the beaten path to explore how food reflects an evolving Asian-Pacific America. Heidi Chang spoke with her when Off the Menu premiered at the Hawaii International Film Festival in Honolulu.
Over the past two decades, filmmaker Grace Lee says Americans have become much more aware of Asian cuisine because of the influence of a growing Asian American community and Asian immigrants. Lee is Korean American.
For example, me, I grew up in the 80s in Columbia, Missouri, where there were very few Asians. And, you know, we sort of kept our kimchi to ourselves in our basement refrigerator. And nobody ever, you know, we never exposed it to anybody. But now kimchi is so popular, as we say in the film, on put it on quesadillas, on burgers. It's like a condiment like sriracha.
Tofu is another recent popular addition to the American menu, showing up in unexpected places. In Texas, Gary Chu, the son of Taiwanese immigrants, runs Banyan Foods, the oldest tofu factory in the state. He told Lee about some of the products they've developed to reach a broader market.
In 2000, we started doing tofu egg rolls. In 2005, we started doing tofu tamales, which is a Asian Tex-Mex fusion.
Lee says Chu's family business is an example of how Asian Americans have adapted to other cultures.
It may not be authentically Chinese or something that you get, or authentically Mexican because of the ingredient of tofu, but it does reflect their existence as Asian Americans in Texas, where there is a Tex-Mex culture, Tex-Mex food, and actually in the factory, you know, most of the employees are Latino, so they're also sort of fusing together their cultures.
Off the Menu captures the role food plays in people's lives, connecting family, culture, and community. At the Sikh Temple in Oak Creek, Wisconsin, Lee visited the scene of the 2012 shooting, where a gunman killed six people during a racially motivated rampage. When the tragedy occurred, the Sikh community was preparing for langar, a communal meal open to everyone.
We're putting some cashews, golden raisins, sugar.
Today, temple members continue to make and share the free communal meal. They say it's helped to heal the community and also feed it spiritually.
We believe that the reason why food is important is because you can't pray, you can't be in tune with God unless your belly is full.
We are not scared of anybody coming to our Gurdwara. So still our doors are open, our hearts are open, our langar is open for them. And we feel honored when they come to us and join with us on our langar.
Off the Menu ends its journey in Hawaii, where most of the state's food is now imported. But it wasn't always like that. These days, some native Hawaiians continue to gather food just like their ancestors. Hi'ile Cavello learned how to do it from her father, Gabby Cavello.
All my life we've been in the water, gathering whatever we can to survive.
But the mainstay for our family is octopus. This is something that's basically sustained our family in this area for eight generations.
Hi'ile says being able to carry on their cultural traditions is an important part of her identity. And preserving their island way of life means a lot to her family.
When we do family luau, we still gather everything ourselves. The whole point of a luau is that the family comes together and you're pooling the resource that's either grown or harvested. And so when you eat it, you're eating the essence of all the skills from passed down from generation to generation. When you take that bite of that food, you're eating that. Food has mana. Food possesses mana. Mana is really the essence of everything. You can taste the love and the history behind that food.
By presenting the history and the stories behind the food, filmmaker Grace Lee hopes Off the Menu gives people a better understanding of the experience of Asian Pacific Americans. For VOA News, I'm Heidi Chang in Honolulu.
That report is making me a bit hungry there. It sounds such great food. Well, this reminder that our leading breaking story is about the Brazilian Senate has voted to oust Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff. Please stay tuned to VOA News and also look at our website at voanews.com for all the very latest. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks very much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The terrorist group Boko Haram has exacted a heavy toll on the people of Nigeria. The group has killed more than 20,000 people, displaced more than 2 million, and plunged some 7 million Nigerians into hunger and desperate need. In the past 2 years, Boko Haram has used more than 100 women and girls to carry out attacks. Speaking in Nigeria, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said, "No one anywhere should have to live among this evil, but it isn't going to disappear on its own." In recent months, there has been progress on the battlefield against Boko Haram. Over the last 6 months, the Nigerian army has rescued thousands of civilian hostages, and hundreds of Boko Haram fighters have surrendered to the Nigerian army. But beating Boko Haram on the battlefield is only the beginning of what needs to be done, said Secretary Kerry. To effectively counter violent extremism, military action needs to be coupled with a commitment to values like good governance, education, security, and respect for human rights. The fight against corruption has to be a priority of the first order, said Secretary Kerry. There is nothing more demoralizing to citizens than the belief that the system is rigged against them. The most basic duty the government has is to meet the needs of its people and to be accountable. Governments must provide equal opportunity for all, giving women and girls an equal chance to compete in the classroom and in the workplace. Finally, the government needs to promote compassion and understanding for fellow citizens. Breaking the terrorist cycle of violence requires treating those who escape or defect from Boko Haram, and particularly those who are abducted against their will, with sensitivity as they try to return to their old communities. Welcoming these individuals, especially women and girls, back into society without the threat of violence or discrimination, and ensuring that the millions who have been displaced in Nigeria and throughout the region get the humanitarian and government support that they desperately need. This, said Secretary Kerry, is the way you invest in a future that is free from violence and provides the stability and peace that Nigerians so desperately want.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.